Today's the 19th, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is September 19th, 2017. Welcome back. Good to see everyone after a long, hot, smoky summer. We're going to start with the adoption of the committee rules. And okay, open an organizational meeting. Thank you, Madam Administrator. For the purpose of adopting the committee rules, these rules are the same as they were last time around that we approved last year. They're on OLIS. They have to do with quorum, meetings, committee action, recordings, field trips, subcommittees, attribution of sponsorship requests, and rules amendments. So they are exactly the same. Hopefully everyone has had an opportunity to read them. And is there any further discussion? Because otherwise we will...
Well, I was wondering if the other my other vice chair might want to read the entire.
No, thank you. I'm good.
That's nice of you to all.
I know this committee does its homework really well, before. So thank you for having read the committee rules. And may I have a motion?
You want me to give you a motion?
Yes, please.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 19th, 2017.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 19, 2017. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Excused.
Representative Nierman?
Yes.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Excused.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Yes.
Chair
yes. Okay, the motion passes. Rules are adopted. Close the organizational meeting. And I would like to do a quick introduction of committee members in case you forget each other and for those of you in the audience or who are listening in. So, Representative Nierman, would you like to start? Just who you are and what district do you represent?
Oh, yeah. So I'm State Representative Mike Nierman. I'm from House District 23, which is across from across the river from here. The biggest city in my district is Dallas, and I describe the district as it's like one of those big, huge cookies with the M&Ms in it, and some 10-year-old kid came and ate all the M&Ms out of it, and mine's just the dough that's left. So it's not Newburgh, not McMinnville, not West Salem, not Independence, not Monmouth, not Corvallis, not Philomath. Wow. There's more deer than people in my district, and thankfully the deer don't vote.
That is a great description. I will now remember it.
Wow. That was impressive. Chris Gorsuch, District 49, East Multnomah County. So I have North Gresham, which I share the rest of Gresham with Representative Peluso. Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and about that much of the city of Portland.
Andy Olson, State Representative out of Albany.
Lisa Kenny-Geyer, House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland.
Representative Tana Sanchez, House District 43, North and Northeast Portland.
All right. I'm Duane, Southern Oregon, prettiest district in the state. Unfortunately, it's also a district where 2 months a year we're all smokers.
Ron Noble, District 24, which is McMinnville to Hillsboro, and the heart of wine country.
Uh-huh. Representative Meek.
Mark Meek from Oregon City Gladstone, House District 40. And, yeah, need to work on that transportation package for Stafford Road there.
Stafford Road.
Oh, and I'm Cassie Susie. I'm the LPRO analyst for this committee.
Okay, great. All right, we're going to open an informational meeting with Oregon Department of Human Services and our new director. It's very exciting.
Acting.
Acting director? Okay. Fair Boys, Hacksherest. Help me pronounce that correctly.
You did it.
I did it? Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny-Geyer and Vice Chairs Olson and Sanchez. Members of the committee, for the record, Fairbors Paksoresht, acting director of the Department of Human Services until the Senate decides later this morning.
Oh, okay.
You need some help with that. I was just
we'll see after the next hour.
So just a brief background. I think most of you know me. I've worked for the state of Oregon for the past 27 and a half years in a variety of state agencies, including Department of Administrative Services, Department of Human Services, and then Oregon Youth Authority. From 2008 to 2012, I was deputy director. And then from 2012 just until last month, I was director. The governor asked me to take on this new role, and some of your colleagues have referred me to Oregon State Hospital for evaluation. See why I do this. But frankly, you know, the short answer to that is I think Senator Winters put it best. Some people plant gardens and sit in the shade and enjoy it. Some people plant gardens and go plant other gardens. So hopefully I can do the job that I'm asked to do in a way that would make the organization proud and all of you proud. This is a big organization. I'm not naive about what I've taken on and what I'm walking into. But, you know, the past 9 years where I've been gone from Department of Human Services, many things have changed. The agency has split into two agencies. Within, this is actually my 12th working day on the job. So in the past 12 days, I've just tried to meet some of the old faces, some of the new many new faces that have come to the agency during these past 9 years that I've been gone. I really do want to thank Clyde Psyche, the former director of the Department of Human Services, a good friend of mine, who has helped me tremendously over the past few months and has involved me in many meetings, have played a mentoring and supporting role. And he, again, my thanks to him for staying for a three-week period of transition. I think this week is his last working week on the job, and officially his last day would be the end of the month. My early observations from the agency is that we have many dedicated and caring people who are willing to step up and do the work when and if they're asked. I see that the environment is ripe for progress, and the agency has the right mission and vision and values, and there's a lot of good work that's already occurring in many areas. So briefly, my priorities are delivering on the key initiatives, something that all of you are concerned about, child safety. And then the other piece is this integrated eligibility, which really is in two pieces. One is the IT system, which is a huge project. But more so, how do we actually operate as one integrated agency? Consolidation is different than integration. We can put services and people together, but operating as one integrated entity to come across seamless to our consumers and to those who use our services is a huge undertaking. And that's something that the agency has been trying to do with some success over the course of the past probably about 20 years, and I think that continues, and I will do my best to move that vision forward. Determining the field structure in order to deliver integrated services is a pretty important piece of that. That's something that we'll be engaged in over the course of the next few months, doing an assessment of what structure we need to have in order to deliver on that integrated vision. Getting the right people in the right positions. Again, we have great people, but sometimes matching talent and abilities with what's asked of them to do is pretty important. Enhanced use of research, data, and analytics. Those of you who know me know that part of the reason that the governor asked me to do this work is the work that we've done in Oregon Youth Authority with use of research, data and analytics that had been noticed nationwide, and I hope to bring some of that knowledge. Not, you know, I myself am not knowledgeable in that, but I know people who are, and, you know, we'll bring that to various areas of the agency. Strengthening the agency's performance and the performance management system, I think, is pretty important to identify what the work is in each different area of the agency. How does that work get done? who's responsible for it? How do we know that we're doing that work well? And at the end of the day, if we do all that work the way that it's supposed to be done, what's the outcome? So I think those are what we'll be focusing on over the next few months to begin putting that structure in place. And of course, all of you know, everyone talks about culture change. And it's easy to talk about. It's a very difficult thing to do. I hope to help the organization create an environment where employees are valued, they're given the resources and the tools that they need to do the job, and accountability begins with me and cascades through the organization. And my hope has been and is that when I come here and sit in front of you, I can look you in the eye and tell you exactly what's happening, to be as transparent as I can. Everything's open for anyone to come in and take a look at, and hopefully use you as our guide. And naturally, you know, you're our major stakeholder, and I need your help in order to move us forward in a way that you can be proud of the work that the agency does. And finally, strengthening equity and inclusion. I know that's important to most of you, and given that we are the largest state agency with most number of employees, we'll try to do as much as we can to move that forward. You also wanted me to give you an update on the new child welfare director, so that was my first priority as I was asked to do this job. Last week, we announced our new child welfare director. Some of you, a few of you have, she contacted you, and whether you met face-to-face or over the phone, you've gotten to get a flavor of who she is. Her name is Marilyn Jones. She's worked for the organization since 1998. And she, for the past 10 years, has been the district manager for District 13, which includes Baker, Union, and Wallawa counties in eastern Oregon. She has a business background. She and her husband fostered 11 foster children and adopted two. She has experience from various parts of the system. That gives her a distinct advantage. To get in there and do the job, she's not here this week. She's taking a week of vacation before she walks into this. She's moving her family from Baker City to Salem, which is a big move. We are preparing for her arrival. I will commit to give her the support and the resources and all of the infrastructure that's required in that organization to be successful. We are grateful to the legislature to give us the resources in child welfare last session to move forward with many pieces that we needed to make that program successful. I do want to take a moment and express my appreciation to Lori Price for stepping in this interim period and doing this very difficult job while we hired Marilyn. I also like to specifically thank Clyde for working side by side with Lori over the course of the past few months to keep the program moving forward. You all know about the Unified Child Safety Plan that's moving forward. A lot of good things are being put in place. And finally, I have sought the help of KCE Family Foundation around identifying best practices across the nation and helping us. In fact, we are doing a planning session on Thursday to begin drafting the future of what child welfare may look like in Oregon. And I can tell you on the record that my goal and Marilyn's goal will be to have a system in Oregon that's noticed as a best practice within the next 3 to 5 years. That is not an easy thing to do, but we can do it. And we cannot do it without your help and without your guidance, but we'll be contacting. I just met with Representative Sanchez yesterday, Representative Stark, with the experience that he has seeing various parts of the systems, and some of the rest of you who have great passion, helping children, and seeing the agency perform. So that's my plan. I'll stop right there and see if you have any questions. You're going to let me go easy, huh?
Yeah. Surprise.
It's your birthday.
So you have really good questions. I did have a very good phone call with Marilyn, and I'm very, very hopeful about that. I love the way she entered the system just as a parent with having kids and then wanting to help out in the office and then doing several levels within the office before becoming district manager and then having, important viewpoint from the district about what the state DHS was doing. So I think those are all really helpful outsider / insider perspectives that are going to really serve her well. So I'm very hopeful about that. Did either of you want to say anything about your thoughts about child welfare in particular?
I'm just excited that we're moving forward and that we're, that we have a plan and that, we just start fresh and see what we can do and make happen. I think I had not the longest conversation. I would really like to sit down with Marilyn and really have a more in-depth conversation, but I think from that first, little bit of conversation I had with her, I feel like she's got some great skill set. She's, done some change in her own area, and I think that if we can advance that further in the state and look at wider possibilities, we have a shot at this 3 to 5 year plan.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Sanchez. If I might just briefly add, in the recruitment process, I sought, again, the help of Casey Family Foundation. We identified 15 potential candidates nationwide, and we basically narrowed that down to 3. Marilyn was one of them. And we were lucky that we had an internal candidate that could step up and do this. As you all know, when you bring someone from outside of Oregon, from a different state, it takes at least 5 or 6 months for the onboarding process. And frankly, I just didn't think that we had time to do that. And given that we had an internal candidate that was as qualified as Marilyn, we moved forward.
That's exciting. Yes.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
One of the things that's come up in my district, and it's not so much about child welfare, but about DHS in general, has been the location of offices.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a problem in Gresham where the office was moved very far to the west. And we were not exactly clued in on what was happening with a lot of lead time. And I just hope that you'll be able to look at that. I understand DHS doesn't own its own buildings that you rent, but it left us with somewhat less than a good feeling for the fact that, well, we can only get this way down in 122nd when a lot of the need was out further east. So if you have the time, once you're settled in, I'd appreciate some focus on how we locate things and hopefully a focus on putting offices in the best geographic location rather than, well, it's where we could find the rent.
Chair Kenegaya, Representative Gorsak, I'll absolutely do that. I'll commit to come and meet with you and not only explain why we made that decision. I don't know why, but I'll find out. But also our process, because I know that there's a process in place for making those decisions. And my first job in DHS actually was the manager of facilities.
Oh, okay. Mm.
And I learned quickly that if you mess with people's space and parking space, they will hurt you. So
there you go. Well, so, and just as a quick follow-up, it seemed like there was a disconnect between the operations people and the facilities people.
Right.
And this was an issue for Senator Lori Montes-Anderson, Representative Peluso, and myself. So
we'll come and we'll explain to you the process and
very good.
We'll be more mindful in the future.
Thank you.
I believe that you have Kim Fredlund from Self-Sufficiency here to talk about EITC.
Right. And we also have Dr. Richardson, I think, talking about, Unified Child Youth Safety Plan.
Perfect.
Yes.
Before you turn it over to them, is there anything you'd like to say? I recognize this is your 12th day, but some of the other really big items are obviously this group dealt with aging and disabilities in a very big way in terms of long-term care facilities and long-term care referral agents. So we had a couple of really big bills on that, and we'll be continuing to work on that. and we'll be looking forward to working in more in the home care arena of long-term care as well coming up. And so I think that'll be on the agenda in November. But anything that you would like to say about that and the other big issue that we've been hearing about but has been more in the budget committee is the cutbacks on disabilities and the number of children impacted by that. Again, I recognize these are just your 12th day, but as you've gone around kind of getting your high-level view, anything that you'd like to say at this time about any of those big areas of...
Chair Kenegaard, members of the committee, I am, of course, still learning about these issues. We are having several conversations later today about the unspecified cuts in DD. Mm-hmm. And the impact of that. I know that these were difficult decisions for the legislature, and you know, in the process of having conversations about this, we hopefully will come up with other options, because these, as you know, impact people with disabilities, seniors, etc. The reality has been, because of the crisis in child welfare, the organization has paid most of his attention to that program, and I'm talking simply from the seat of the director. We have very capable program directors in all five areas. Mm-hmm. But, and frankly, you know, Clyde has had to come in and do that in order to get child welfare stabilized. Mm-hmm. And with the work that he's done, it now allows me to pay more attention to the rest of the program, because in this programs, in this organization, we have five different programs. And hopefully we can pay attention to all of those. And, you know, the population that we serve, there may be just a couple of other state agencies that touch the entire continuum of life, all the way from pre-birth to transition. And some of the consumers or clients that we have, we are trying to get back on their feet to continue a productive life, and some of them will be with us for the rest of their lives. So it is important to identify the distinctions that exist among these programs, but at the same time, the point of connections that exist within them. Children grow up to be adults. Adults grow up to be seniors. And in between, you know, many other things that happen that might require our services. You know, my hope is, as I begin to learn about the various programs within the organization, and this committee is a pretty important committee for us in human services, so we'll be having conversations with you and hopefully working together to identify what resources do we need to do the work that you're asked to do, but at the same time, what does accountability look like, so that you can be confident that we are actually being prudent with how we're spending our resources. How do we know that we're actually performing and arriving at the outcomes and results that we want? And through that transparency, hopefully we'll come to a place where we collectively know what we need. And, you know, if we can't get the resources that we need, then we should be able to identify what we can do, clarifying expectations, and then actually communicating it to those people who are receiving services. I know there are big issues as far as the K plan in DD, and APD is also impacted by that, and I look forward to having those conversations.
Great. Any other questions? Well, very excited to have you on board. I agree that Director Psyche did a fabulous job, and we will miss him, but we're really delighted that he was a part of recommending a replacement that he had full trust in. You've done a fantastic job in the time I've known you at OIA, and really look forward to working with you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. So who would you like to come have call next from your team?
Dr. Richardson.
Okay.
And my apologies, I got to go next door. So.
Good morning, Chair Kenegaard and members of the committee. To refresh the record, I'm Dr. Reginald Richardson. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Human Services. And this is my 26th month on the job.
No one's counting.
One of the long-standing veterans. Well, I was going to use the new guy, so I guess I can't use that. The purpose of me being here this morning is to really to update you on our progress that we're making to improve child safety. Representative Stark and Senator Gelser both sit on the steering team for the Unified Child and Safety Implementation Plan, and we appreciate their participation. In fact, the steering team is meeting as we speak, which is why you're stuck with me. Mm-hmm. We're now working on 10 improvement projects from the plan that we prioritized by the community-based steering group. The work of the projects can really be bucketed into five major areas. One is the improved placement options for children, improvements in child protection, meeting children's specific safety needs, and then foster parents, foster family support and training, and then finally caseworker support and training. We've gotten some momentum going. We would say that the work has hit a stride and we're moving forward, and we continue to build on the work that we've done thus far. We're committed to pursuing these projects until completion using rigor of the project management strategy, data and research, and an inclusive community-based process. Not to mention, in terms of this community-based process, we're in a process of setting up community tours around the state to make sure that we're engaging the community along this work as well. I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have. We've posted on OLIS examples of the work, the five bucketed areas, but I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Questions? Oh, good. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm just glad he's been here for 26 months.
Yeah.
I guess that's
true.
You probably got your war wounds to show it. About seeking mental health.
It is my pleasure to serve as the Deputy Director of DHS.
I'm glad you're here.
Thank you, Representative.
Hello.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you
so much. Okay, Kim Fredland.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Chair Representative Kimney Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kim Fredland. I'm the self-sufficiency director. To continue the, you know, longevity, I'm in my 26th and a half year with the department. So
there you go.
She definitely has mental health. Thank you for your service.
Thank you. I'm pleased to join you this morning to talk just really briefly about the efforts that we've made around the Earned Income Tax Credit project. So in Oregon for I guess I'm a little out of practice this morning. So I'm going to just talk a bit about the background, why we took on this project, the work group, and the future efforts that we have. So in 2016, we convened a work group really at the request of the chair because in Oregon, we are near the bottom of the states in utilization or families getting this claiming this tax credit. And so we wanted to try some strategies to see if we could make an improvement. One of the challenges.
Director Fredland, for 1 second, I just want to stop you there for 1 second. And one of the things that's really important about that is that we leave millions of dollars of federal money on the table because there's a state EITC tax credit and there's a federal EITC. And when people don't claim it or are not aware of it, they don't get either. So it's more money in the pockets of low-income families that go into their economy, but it's also leveraging federal dollars. So just want to say partly why that's so important.
Yes. And I would say that with the amount that each family would get, it makes, especially when they're a family in poverty, this amount of money is a significant amount that, that really increases overall that yearly total income that they have. And so when we convened the group, it was members of the Department of Revenue, Housing and Community Services, the Employment Department, the Oregon Health Authority, Department of Education, Veterans Affairs, 211 Info, Cash Oregon, and the Community Action Partnership of Oregon program. So we convened the group, and one of the first things that we identified was two issues. One is that it takes a significant amount of time to see if any of your strategies actually make an improvement, because we're so far behind in the data of understanding who accessed the tax credit and who did not. And so I think that's going to continue to be a challenge as we move forward, because we won't know any of the strategies that we employed in 2016, we won't really know until 2019, 2020 if that made a difference. The other challenge that we had is we really, we convened this group without any funding behind it to really do any analysis or try to find out why do we have such a low utilization. So we were left with really making a few what we hope are educated guesses about why the utilization is low. So our approach to trying to increase that is increasing awareness. So we really had a campaign between all of the organizations. We just pulled a few off of the self-sufficiency awareness. We did a campaign with all of our field offices to make sure we had brochures at all of the desks in the state. We made sure that staff were really aware. We had several campaigns on our social media. We sent out mailers for our SNAP participants. And this was just a self-sufficiency approach. There was also several campaigns through Cash Oregon. The Oregon Health Authority had some good branding and information that they sent out. There was a video that they put on their social media. So we were really attacking it from that awareness place. We also agreed that a similar branding, and so on the first page, I should have pointed that out on the first page. On the first page of the presentation, the branding that we chose was Claim Your Money, because we wanted people to be aware that this was money that they were leaving on the table. And so that was the approach that we took. So our future efforts is we all agreed as the work group finished up its 2016 tax season work that we would reconvene earlier for the 2017 tax year. So that's in the works soon. Within the next 60 days, we should be getting together and really approaching what is the next set of data that we have to look at and see what that utilization is. And again, an awareness and any other information that we've gathered in the interim to see if there's any other strategies that we might be able to employ for no money. Any questions?
Go ahead. Not,
a different topic.
Different so, from EITC.
Yeah.
So, thank you. I can't wait to hear the results.
Yes.
In terms of how many people actually claim it. Are you seeing an uptick, or is this just done mostly after the last tax preparation period of last January to April? The question is, are you seeing an uptick in the number of people utilizing Cash Oregon and AARP's services?
Chair Kenny Geyer, I have not heard any updates to see if they saw an increased utilization. Mm-hmm. That's something that we would explore when we bring the committee back together.
Okay. So yes. This January to April will be critical.
Yes.
In seeing that. And the second question is, getting the word out is one thing, and then making sure that you have the infrastructure of the nonprofit groups that are doing the free tax preparation is also important. Has there been any resources devoted to supporting that throughout the state? And I know the rural areas It appeared from the data I last saw a couple years ago. And it was the rural areas that were actually even farther behind, mm-hmm. which is where mm-hmm. we need more money in families' pockets.
So, I, again, I'm not aware that there has been an effort in that way, but we can certainly talk with the committee about providing that update when next we provide you an update.
Thank you. And then the last thing I want to say is that Department of Revenue is a really, really important partner in this.
Yes.
You may remember I felt they were dragging their feet too much for a couple of reasons. One is they had actually taken the EITC box off of the tax forms. So I'm curious if they're back on the tax form. I know there's only a certain number of questions that you can ask, and so some things kind of rotate. But that, in this effort to increase awareness, that was one piece I thought was important. And the other was making sure that on the homepage itself that we had some awareness of this. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank the governor's office and Ivo Trummer in particular for making sure that that did happen. And now on the very homepage for Department of Revenue, you've got free tax prep services available. It would be great to see the claim your money, actually, but that is a really big improvement. And when you, because it used to take me 3 to 5 clicks, depending on where I started, to get to the point of even finding out about EITC mm-hmm. or free tax preparation. So now it's on the homepage, and then when you click that on that very next page, you've got the earned income tax credit. It'd be good, again, for your branding effort to have the claim your money here and really get people's attention, but I do want to thank you for the real progress that you've made so far. Yes, Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, is there a difference between EITC and EIC? Because the 1040 EZ I see for 2016 doesn't have an EITC, has an EIC.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Meek, I will say that I am not an expert on the different tax categories, and so someone from Department of Revenue would probably be able to answer that better than I
am. And I see it. Would you like to come up briefly, Representative John Mullen?
And then, yeah. Madam Chair, then the other question is that are some of these folks are probably receiving benefits. Do they even know that they should file a tax return because none of those benefits are taxable, and who is helping them with that?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Meek, that was really the approach that we took in the last tax season, is to make sure that our offices was sharing that awareness with families so that they would apply because I think that sometimes if somebody is working a job only for a couple of months, they might not think it's worth it to file, or that they might not know how, they might not know where there's a
or
free
they think they
location.
Don't owe tax because they're such a low income and don't realize that they could
yes.
be.
So that was really why we wanted to come together with Department of Revenue and really make sure that our families were aware and that we were doing that awareness campaign. So, again, it's so challenging to have a strategy and not be able to see if your results have paid off. So we're hopeful that has actually made an improvement.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. Our organization has a history with the creation of the EIC in the state of Oregon. We created that term just to create a bit of a distinction between the federal earned income tax credit and the state earned income credit, which is based on a percentage of the federal earned income tax credit. And the percentage, I believe, is 8% and 11% with families, children under 3. So advocates have always been interested to see the EIC, the state version of it, expand over a period of time. But as Kim has pointed out, it's really very important for clients to understand that they're eligible for both. I hope that
helps. And I'll take that opportunity to add something for those of you who weren't in the legislature a couple of years ago. That is when we made a real attempt to try to increase it, particularly for families with children who are daycare age, if we want them to have the ability to work, because it's earned income, it's you get it back on your earned income, then we know they have additional expenses from childcare. And so we wanted to make sure that they had a particular boost, or if they chose to stay at home and thus were earning less income because they have children, that that was another way. We weren't trying to say to people with a tax credit, you should work and you get more, or you should stay at home and you get more. It actually helps people in young families in both those situations. The Oregon Center for Public Policy had done a study at the time that said in order for people to not pay any state tax at all, the EITC should really be, or the EIC, it should really be 12%. That unless you have it at 12%, when you are still paying more net taxes to the state than you're getting back. And is that really what we want to do to our lowest income people? And so I think the goal had been to try to get it at 12% for everyone, mm-hmm. and higher than that for young children, but we got as far as we could at that point in time. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Am I remembering those numbers correctly?
The amount that would cause a situation where a person would not pay taxes changes year to year.
Yeah.
So we had estimated at one point in time as high as 18%.
Uh-huh.
But that number needs to be recalibrated.
Every
I think
year.
That's important information
right.
to know about what level would it achieve the goal of having people that are low income not having to pay state income tax.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Chair Kinnegar. Different topic, but WIC, since beginning, changing from the tangible paper checks that were a nightmare to the actual card, have we seen increased utilization?
Chair Kinnegar and Representative Stark, the WIC program is not through the self-sufficiency program, so I would not be able to answer that.
Department of Health,
yes.
I believe, right?
Yes.
Department of Health.
Yes.
But that raises another question. Thank you, Representative Stark. Representative Hayden had a bill that was to try to divide child care payments into monthly, and the bill was to have request a waiver from the federal government to ensure that if they did that, mm-hmm. that it would not be count as earned income that would be taxable. Are you aware of that, and has the waiver been sent in?
Mm-hmm. Chair Kinnegar, absolutely. We did work with Representative Hayden on the actual waiver request, and we did submit that sometime during session. It seems like it was maybe even early or mid-session we submitted that. It's been pretty slow to hear any results from the federal government at this point on that. We have not heard back on that waiver request.
Please let us know when
we will
get that back.
Yes.
Thank you. Any other questions? No, great. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That, I believe, wraps up presentations from Department of Human Services. Is
yes,
that right?
I believe so.
Great. Thank you so much. We had told Director Salazar from Housing and Community Services to start at 9, and because we are ahead of schedule, I am wondering if John Van Lanningham, you are ready to do your presentation, which... So Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition update. And please explain also why you are the only person here, given that we did invite some of the other members of the coalition, but they were not available.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Lanningham. I work as a lawyer for, where do I work? Lane County Legal Aid / Oregon Law Center, because we merged with the Oregon Law Center in this, at the beginning of this calendar year. I've produced two documents for you that are on OLIS. One is a list of issues being worked on by the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which I will henceforth refer to as the coalition, although there used to be two coalitions, one for apartment law and one for manufactured housing park landlord-tenant law. And I'm only going to be talking about the latter. So the chair also asked me to, Cassie did ask me to talk about Marina landlord-tenant law, so I'll do that too. And there's a document on OLIS that describes the difference between manufactured housing park landlord-tenant law and marina landlord-tenant law. So I'll talk more about marina tenancies in a few minutes. To respond directly to the chair's request, she asked that both a tenant representative, which is me, and a landlord representative, park landlord representative, appear this morning. The main landlord representative would be Chuck Carpenter, who has been the director, the executive director of the largest landlord group. There are two landlord groups, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, MHCO. That's the one that Chuck is the executive director of. The other is Oregon Park Owners Alliance, and it is represented by a Portland lawyer named John DiLorenzo. Both Chuck Carpenter and John DiLorenzo are unavailable today. So you're stuck with me. And I think that's okay with Chuck. I don't know that it's okay with Mr. DiLorenzo, but you'll have to live with that.
But just for the record, when they weren't available to come speak, nor are they available in November, because that was the other option of having them all together, but they have their actual coalition meeting at the same time as our legislative day in November. They were also invited to put something on the record. They haven't at this point, and so I know that they're communicating their thoughts through you, John, and we will invite them again in November to put something on the record since they won't be able to be here.
And I'm not going to be saying anything controversial this morning, or that they have not both already seen and signed off on. A little background on the coalition. This coalition is an informal, unofficial group which has no particular standing or authority to do anything. It consists of representatives, advocates for both Manufactured Housing Park landlords and Manufactured Housing Park tenants. A Manufactured Housing Park tenant is somebody who owns his or her manufactured home and rents the space for that home in a park. And parks are defined as four or more spaces within 400 feet or something. If you don't own the home, if you rent both the home and the space, you're treated just the same as an apartment tenant. If you own your home and own your land, you're treated the same as a stick-built homeowner. If you own your home and rent something not in a park, different rules apply. Not very many, and there are quite a few of those. Lane County, for example, has a lot of manufactured homes on rural land outside of cities. The coalition began because in 1997, the two sides, landlords and tenants, were fighting in a legislative committee in the state Senate. And the chair at the time, then State Senator Bill Kenemer, got frustrated and told the two sides to go away and not come back until they had worked something out together. So that was a fairly heavy-duty direction. They did. I got involved at that time, and they negotiated a major bill, a major with significant improvements for manufactured housing park landlord tenant law having to do with abandoned manufactured homes. The coalition has continued since 1997. It has had a compromise negotiated bill in every legislative session since 1997. So that's 20 years. 11 sessions, roughly, that it has done that. We had a couple of hiccups, a couple of times when we fell apart, but we've come back together. The most recent hiccup was last fall, but we did come back in time to have a bill in this last legislative session, Senate Bill 277. We've negotiated a lot of issues. A lot of them are complicated and hotly contested. I'm the electronic secretary of the coalition, which means I keep the email list, and I send out the agendas, the written agendas, in advance by email, and I send out drafts. We negotiate issues for a long time. It's a long process. Sometimes I think of it as being like the Stockholm Syndrome. You lock landlords and tenants in a room at the end of 12 months after 10 meetings, 11 meetings of 3 hours each, it's fine. They like each other, oddly enough. And, of course, it falls apart later, but not before the bill passes. So we typically act by consensus. You don't have to agree with it. We have had people who participated and then fell off and opposed a bill in the session. But as long, roughly, as we kept the two main groups, have been MH, Manufactured Housing / Oregon State Tenants Association. I'm a board member, although I'm not a park resident. That group was actually formed in 1977. A lot of the members are seniors. I often say that seniors are great lobbyists because legislators aspire to be a senior. The downside of being a senior lobbyists or legislative advocates is that they tend to die. So we've lost a number of our great members. Milt Schofield founded the organization in 1977. I was lucky enough to meet him because I've been doing this for 40 years. And then Pat Schwach, who died about 3 years ago, sort of picked up the organization in the early 90s and led it forward. So we do negotiate issues to death. As I said, we meet monthly, 3 hours each time. We go over our proposal. We start off by listing an item, describing it, arguing about it, pros and cons. If we think we can move forward, then I might end up drafting something, and we would actually work on the language specific, line by line, word by word, to get to a point that we're comfortable with. And most of us know the law quite well. Even though there aren't that many lawyers involved, there are a couple of landlord lawyers that also participate and give feedback. This last fall, there were some concerns raised that I had too much control, and so we adopted a process document just earlier this month, in which we will have two co-facilitators, me on behalf of tenants and John DiLorenzo on behalf of landlords, and that we will have four groups that, quote, get to vote. We've never really had voting in the past. As I said, we've always operated by consensus. But this now we'll have four voting groups, the two landlord groups, MH OSTA and Legal Aid. And if three out of four groups support the bill, we'll go forward. The other group has the right to oppose, and if we represent that the coalition supports a bill, we'll have to report in writing that one of the four groups doesn't support the bill. So I should also say that anybody can come to a coalition meeting, and often they do. Mm-hmm. And anybody can speak at a coalition meeting. Even though there are only four voters, the document we just adopted on our process makes it very clear that anybody is entitled to come and anybody is entitled to speak up. And DiLorenzo and I are now taking turns facilitating the meetings. Again, the goal is to reach agreement. That's a difficult process, but we've done, and as a result, of course, it's compromise. So you don't get everything you want, neither side does. But we, I think, accomplished a bunch of important things. So the document on OLIS is entitled Issues for Discussion for the 2019 Legislative Session. We do not intend to produce something for 2018, but for 2019, that's the list in front of you. And there's a lot of items on that list. There's no way in the world that we're going to get through all those items. We've started with the first one, enforcement, and we will also be talking soon about a simplified for-cause termination process. Right now, manufactured housing park tenants can only be terminated for cause, for a good reason. Now, you will remember that was a proposal in the last legislative session. HB 2004 proposed to do the same thing for apartment tenants. Manufactured housing park tenants have had that right since they were first regulated by Oregon law in 1975. So the proposal here, number two, has to do with a concern that some landlords have and some tenants agree that there are difficult or bad problem tenants in a park and it's hard to get them out. I don't know how we're going to cut that baby, but that's the issue, and that's what we'll be working on. Enforcement refers to the fact that there is no statewide program or state agency that, quote, enforces landlord-tenant law. It's a rare thing, actually, in the U.S. for that. It's a civil matter. People get to sue each other, but we don't have anything independently that would investigate a concern and enforce that statute. And frequently I'll have manufactured housing park tenants say in my talking to them that, yes, we've passed great laws. Manufactured housing park tenants have good rights, but they can't enforce them. They either are afraid of trying to enforce them individually, or they can't afford a lawyer, because enforcement now in a civil system basically means you sue somebody, you sue a landlord, you get a lawyer. Or Washington State has a program funded by park residents and park landlords for the attorney general to investigate complaints and enforce the law from both sides, although frankly the complaints run something like 95-5 by tenants as opposed to landlords. We're going to look at different models. We started the conversation last month. We had our first serious meeting for 2019 earlier this month, and we started talking about enforcement, trying to figure out some way to do that. I'd be happy to run through that list, but I'd probably bore the pants off of all of you if there are any questions about the list. There are some items on there in which some legislators have asked the coalition to look at. One of those, for example, is opportunity to purchase issues. You may recall that a couple years ago, the legislature passed a law requiring park landlords who choose to sell their parks to give the tenants notice and an opportunity to compete. Not a right of first refusal. It's an opportunity to compete. There are some advantages to selling to your residents. And one of the big ones is if you sell to the residents or to a nonprofit, there's a capital gains break, state capital gains break under Oregon state law. It's worth about 10% of the value. So there's a benefit to the owner to do that. There's concern that some landlords continue to put their parks up for sale without complying, without giving notice to the tenants. And that's happened a couple of times in Portland, including just this past summer, which that law has been in effect since 2014. People should know about that. So there's a concern that the enforcement isn't effective enough, the remedy isn't effective enough, or maybe there's something we can do with regard to realtors who are offering these parks for sale that the realtors ought to know. Maybe we should work with a real estate agency to educate realtors about that, title companies, things like that. Any questions about the coalition? Okay, marinas. I want to note first that in the audience are two people who know more about marinas than I do. There are no marinas, I think, in Lane County, where I have worked for the last 40 years. And those two people are Jan Hammer, with a blue shirt, who is a park owner and a marina owner and an expert on marinas, and Angela Garvin, who lives in a marina in the Portland area, sitting next to him. So if you have questions about marinas, I probably will defer to them. Marinas are similar to parks in that it is a fixed space, and the tenant owns his or her floating home and rents a slip in a marina that's on water. That's, I think, the gist of what you need to know about it. I've given you a handout that lists all of the – I went through the entire statutes that regulate manufactured housing parks and floating homes. They are treated in – they're in the same sections of the statute. And there are some practical differences. For example, we have a habitability standard for manufactured home parks that a park owner has to do certain things, and if the park owner doesn't provide electricity, water, safety from fire, things like that, the tenant can withhold rent or can sue to force the landlord to make repairs. More common to think of that in apartment law, but it's true for park law as well in terms of the basic utilities. Marinas have mostly the same, except for parks, one of the habitability requirements is that the land be level and stable, because if the land slips, the manufactured home moves. And an unlevel manufactured home is a bad thing. They are often in sections. They're sealed together. It could really mess with your home. And there are some parks that are built on bad land. Same concern is there for marina residents, but it's a whole different world, because for them, if the water level drops, and it sometimes does, their floating home could hit the bottom and also tilt. But you can't make a marina landlord dig up the land under a body of water. That's regulated by various government agencies. So that would be a different deal. So we have the statutes there are slightly different. There is no duty on a marina owner to provide a level space, which probably doesn't make marina residents too happy. But if you look at that list that I've given you, you can see that there's a lot of rights that park and marina tenants both have. Those are different from apartment tenants. Marina and park tenants have more rights than apartment tenants. That largely reflects two things. One, the manufactured home owner or the floating home owner has a huge investment in the park or the marina. And if they get evicted from their park or marina, they're probably going to lose their home. And those homes are often worth a lot of money. That's especially true with floating homes. Angela can tell you the general value of floating homes, but they are not cheap. There are some cheap manufactured homes, $5,000, $10,000. But there are also manufactured homes worth more than six figures in beautiful parks, and it's sometimes hard to distinguish them from stick-built homes. Manufactured home production has improved significantly in the last 20 years. So they have more rights because they've got an investment by owning the home. They also have more rights because, frankly, they're a more sympathetic population. As I said, they're seniors, and we all aspire to someday be a senior. I think I am already one. But there are also some distinctions, and I've listed those in B on my handout. Some of those are obvious things, such as with parks, the coalition negotiated a couple years ago provisions saying that if there's a dangerous tree in the park on the common area or on somebody's space, keep in mind that park tenants don't like landlords coming onto their spaces. It makes them uncomfortable. So we negotiate something that says if a tree is a certain size and an expert has determined that it's hazardous, at risk of falling, the landlord has a duty to remove or fix the tree. Well, we don't probably need to do that in marinas because there aren't going to be trees next to those floating homes. I mean, it's possible, but probably not an issue. But there are a couple of things, and park closures, for example. If you've been here in the legislature a long time, you will remember that we negotiated in 2005, park closure rules, so that when a landlord closes a manufactured home park, and you'll remember that in the early 2000s there were a lot of park closures, especially in the Portland metro area, other red-hot areas, landlords were redeveloping, they're selling their parks to developers who would redevelop them as high-end residential housing. So you adopted something that says the landlord has to give a one-year notice, and the landlord has to pay the residents some money to compensate them for the move. And in this last legislative session, House Bill 2008 increased those payments by $1,000 each because they hadn't been changed since 2007. That's not a risk, really, for marinas. You can't redevelop a marina, a body of water, into high-end housing. You could do another marina, but you can't do it otherwise. So we don't have a statute covering that. But the statutes that park tenants have that marina tenants don't have that might be of issue would be in my list there. The first one is that they are not required to be registered with the state, and they're not required to have mandatory continuing education. I often say that for park tenants, there are three big concerns. One is rent levels, second is closure, the third is bad management. We've tried to address bad management by requiring that the landlords get educated. There's that. There is no such requirement for marina landlords that they either register or that they get educated. The other big thing that's a difference, two other ones. One of them has to do with the opportunity to purchase. I talked a little bit about how a couple of sessions ago you passed legislation on opportunity to purchase requiring landlords to give notice. There is no such law, or the new modern improved law does not apply to marinas. And there are marina residents who would be interested in purchasing their park, their marina, if the landlord wanted to sell it. The last thing is, marina residents are not covered by the Manufactured Community Resource Center, what used to be called the Manufactured Home Ombudsman, MCRC. It's a part of Housing and Community Services Division Department. It provides education and training and mediation for landlord-tenant disputes. It is supported entirely by tax on park residents that they implemented and advocated for independently themselves. Started off at $3, increased to $6. A couple sessions ago, we increased it to $10 a year. So park residents pay for MCRC.
Do marina residents not pay that?
No, they do not. Okay. Marina residents do not pay that $10 assessment. They're not covered by MCRC, although sometimes they can get free advice from MCRC, but they're not covered. I've been hesitant to address marina issues in the coalition because we have historically had limited participation by marina landlords or marina residents, and I don't know the issues as well, and it doesn't seem to me the coalition should be advocating on something where we don't really have active participation from marina residents or marina landlords. Patchwalk, I mentioned earlier, the person who revived the tenant, say by tenants group a couple, 10, 15 years ago, tried to get marina residents to join OSA and couldn't find enough interest. So that's my marina law review.
So that's really helpful. And there was an issue that came up since the last session, a concern by marina park owners, which is what prompted us to ask you, why is this not covered and what are the differences? So this is incredibly thorough and deserves relooking at, and whether there should be a seat at the table for marina owners and marina boat owners. Don't know exact term. I think this is really timely because it's clear there should be some differences, but it's also clear that there's a lot of agreements that have been worked out in the coalition that I think the marina boat owners and marina owners could really benefit from all that work you've done to come to decision. So I appreciate whatever the concern was that put this on the table, that gives us an opportunity to make sure that we look at that at the same time. And I'm very appreciative that both of you are here. Can you just remind me what the issue was that put this on our radar?
Angela? Can Angela come? She's the one you're worried about the time.
I'm a little worried about time, but why don't, since you've both come, both of you come up and just say a couple of brief comments, especially in response to what John said, and then we do have to move on, but I'm very appreciative that you both came.
Give your name.
Okay.
And you go first.
My name is Angela Garvin. Thank you for giving me a voice for a moment.
Yeah.
I'm a floating home resident, and we own our floating homes. And I think the biggest issue is, like John said, it's what happens when you get evicted. Mm-hmm. You lose your home. Is basically what happens. Now, the reasons you can get legally evicted are things like having your dog off leash twice in 6 months, or having an oil leak on your car twice in 6 months. Some immaterial things that in a house on land where you own in a neighborhood, you wouldn't necessarily get booted out of your neighborhood. You might get a city fine, but to lose your house, that's different. The assumption, too, is that you have to vacate the space. So a lot of times people say, well, you can move your floating home. And while that's technically true, you at a cost. And the cost is it's astronomical. To buy a slip for your floating home, to purchase it, it's at least $150,000. To move your house into another place where you rent the slip, there's a move-in fee. Typically right now, it's about $45,000 to $50,000. So when you get evicted, I mean, you're done. You have to sell your house, and you have to do it within 70 days. And typically, floating homes take about 6 months longer than a home on land to sell. That's a statistic. So to be forced to sell within 30 to 70 days, you're going to take a huge loss. The other thing is that's a huge issue is there are currently 8 available slips in Oregon. That's a problem because it really does mean you have to sell if you don't have that kind of cash sitting around to move your house. And that's if your house is movable and if you have a space for it. So the enforcement, that's one of the top things on the list for the coalition. I'm very pleased about that. Because, like John said, we aren't a part of that resource and that education. We have no Floating Home Association. I stumbled across this coalition by complete accident. And so I would like to have a forum. I mean, people didn't know that a lot of the people I talk to in marinas don't even know these laws exist to protect them. Mm-hmm. So I imagine that there are some violations that aren't being addressed, and it's basically litigation. I mean, you are entitled to as much justice as you can afford. In our situation, there's no oversight, and the laws are great. that are on there. So those are a couple of the really big differences that I see, and I'm happy to be a part of the coalition to help try and bring more people and more awareness to the issues that we face.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jan Hamer. I own a small houseboat and boat marina out near Scappoose, simple, close by where Angela lives. I'm older than dirt. I've been on John's committee for years, trying to participate, and I think there's always room for improvement. There's no doubt about it. I think I brought along a handout, which I didn't get registered properly, I guess, to pass out.
You can still put it in.
Oh, can you?
For the public,
okay.
Absolutely.
It's a generic set of rules that has been kind of the template over the years for all the marinas. They've copied it and made little changes for their own application, but it's pretty generic. Just to give you an idea of the things that you're faced with that John talked about, I think part of the problem is landlords sometimes don't follow their own rules. They're inconsistent about it. And I think that it's a lack of training about the ORS laws and what the what I would call best practices would comprise of. And MHCO, as John mentioned, does provide training, and I think that it would be very important to take a look at tightening that up and having the marinas participate in that as well, because I think there is an education process that needs to be done there, no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. And I've been at a property manager for 40 years, 20 years on the water, so like the State Farm advertisement, I don't know everything, but I know a little. Anyway, thank you for letting me make comments.
If I could just add, John Manningham. Jan has long been a champion for requiring marina owners to be registered and trained, but he's one voice. And my fear is that without more marina landlords supporting that, if we brought a bill doing that, we might have some issues.
Well, I hope that your coalition will try to work through some of these issues, because I think we all agree that that's the best way to bring something to the committee is when all stakeholders have had a real part and can find consensus. That's not, all, as I've said many times, not the only way that I will hear bills, but it is certainly by far the preferred way. So thank you all so much for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
All right, next we've got Oregon Housing Community Services Director Margaret Salazar. And Ariel Nelson.
Hello, good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. We want to thank the Chair and the committee for inviting us here today to give you an update on the goings-on at our agency. We have a lot of exciting work going on, and we are going to take a few moments just to update you on a number of the new initiative and programs that we're working on and other goings-on at the agency. With me here today is Ariel Nelson, our Legislative and Intergovernmental Affairs Liaison as well. So we wanted to start today's presentation by giving you a year in review. As you may recall, I started my post at the agency in November of 2016. It has been quite an eventful year for myself and for the agency. There's a lot of great work going on, and we wanted to tell you a little bit of that story over the past year. In late fall of 2016, our agency was the subject of a Secretary of State performance audit that we came and talked to you about early in the legislative session. There was some pretty tough feedback in that Secretary of State performance audit, but frankly some great opportunities for us to learn and identify the challenges that we need to meet to take our agency into the future. Some key themes I talked about when I testified before this committee several months ago, identified in that audit, included the need for us to focus on data and technology, really modernizing our data systems, getting a handle on our own affordable housing inventory, and creating a better user experience for our customers and our staff. The need for us to focus on strategic planning and to produce a statewide housing plan, which is mandated by Oregon statute, and we have not completed that in quite some time, so that was a major focus for the agency, as well as really focusing on improving our communication and engagement both internally with our staff at all levels, as well as with our many stakeholders, partners, users of our programs, and our Housing Stability Council. So there were three major themes from the audit. We've been focusing on all of those challenges over the last year, and I'm pleased to say that we've made tremendous progress. On data and technology, we have selected a vendor to migrate our data to a new platform. We're in the contract negotiation phase. But the proposed system will meet the needs of OHCS now and will continue to do so for many years. The implementation process will begin later this fall with the go-live date set for late spring of 2018. So again, what we're doing is modernizing our data platform and creating a portal so that we can receive things like online applications for our funding programs. This is a model that's been used by many other state housing agencies, so we're not reinventing the wheel. We are not custom building a new database. We're taking something off the shelf that has been successful in other states. It will be a huge improvement for our programs. On strategic planning and the statewide housing plan, you'll hear a great deal a little bit later in our presentation about where we are with our statewide housing plan. It's very exciting work. But as part of the responsiveness to the audit, we decided as an agency that we couldn't wait for the statewide housing plan process to be completed to articulate our goals and how we were serving Oregonians and their housing needs. So we created strategic goals for 2017, which outlined seven key areas of focus for the agency and really communicating to our partners and to lawmakers such as yourselves about where we're focusing our energy. For the first time, we've really created measurable outcomes and goals so that we can track our progress. I believe that you've seen copies of those strategic goals for 2017. A few of the examples I just wanted to highlight for you is for the first time we've really set goals, for example, in home ownership. We said that we were going to increase our home purchase program by 33% to do $80 million of activity in 2017. As we all know, home ownership creates a wealth of opportunities for low-income home buyers, not only the stability of owning your own home, but also creating an asset. We are pleased that we've actually blown past that strategic goal for 2017. We set the goal of $80 million. We're not even in the fourth quarter of the year. We're already at $90 million for the year. And having those goals has really helped us to articulate where we're headed as an agency.
So can I stop and ask a question right there? And anyone else who wants to ask a question as she goes, please feel free to. Home ownership is really critical. This committee passed three or four bills last time with, I believe, unanimous support. They went on Ways and Means, and none of them were funded. And so I want to reiterate that this committee has shown very strong support for home ownership programs, and we will continue to advocate for that. I really appreciate the unanimity of our committee on a variety of different approaches to try to increase home ownership. We are 47th in the country. Our rate is 61%. The average rate is 69%. Do you have any sense of what your goal now, where that might put us vis-a-vis other states? I realize you don't know what those states are doing, but at least can you tell us where the 61% might move with that kind of goal?
Chair Kenny Geyer, we will definitely look into our data and be able to report back to you on what this increase in activity for our program would mean for home ownership overall for the state of Oregon and how we compare to other states. In addition to that activity, one of the things we're looking at is ways to modernize our home ownership program so that we can reach more folks. We're looking to bring on new lenders to participate in our home buyer programs, as well as a particular focus on bridging the minority home ownership gap. We have a huge gap in minority home ownership here in Oregon. It's about a 30% differential between people of color who own their homes and the overall population. So we need to push on that. We've been doing a great deal of work this year on gathering data and beginning to outline some strategies. We're not quite there yet in terms of developing a strategy, but we're looking at that very carefully.
Okay, one follow-up question. Where do you get the $80 million? I know that 14% of the document recording fee, which is the whole document recording fee, is only $15 million a year. 14% of that goes to homeownership. What are the other sources of support that you can draw upon?
Certainly. So when we look at homeownership, it's really a whole package. So the $80 million that I'm speaking of is our Oregon Residential Bond Loan Program, where we actually work with private lenders who originate loans, and then we're able to do bonding off of that. So we are able to purchase those loans, and it's below market market interest rates. So we have a very, very competitive interest rate as interest rates are rising in the overall marketplace. But what we do is, for a kind of a whole concerted effort, we work with local housing counseling agencies to provide things like down payment assistance for our first-time homebuyers, as well as our individual development account program, which helps low-income households to save funds to be able to purchase a home. So when you take all of those strategies together, we find that that's a very successful package. So if you will, I'll move on to some other points that I wanted to make. Certainly, another area that we have been focusing on is just shoring up our communications. We have a great deal of initiatives to improve employee engagement at the agency and transparency with our partners, as well as our Housing Stability Council, and those efforts are underway. One of the things that we focused on this past year is really trying to build connections with other state housing agencies so that we can learn from best practices, lessons learned, what's working and what's not working in other states. We've taken the lead on the West Coast to establish a new West Coast Housing Finance Agency exchange. We brought in our counterparts from Washington State and California twice, first in January and then again just last week, to exchange ideas. And we've learned a ton, and we've been able to show off some of the great work going on here in Oregon as well. Just a couple of things that we've gleaned. One was the Land Acquisition Program, which is a successful program that's operating in Washington State. And because of the great work of this and other committees, we were able to see that land acquisition program become a reality here in Oregon this past legislative session. So that's just one example of something that we've learned from. California has a very robust supportive housing program for mental health individuals as well as the greater public. So we've learned a lot from talking with them about what's working in California to make investments for supportive housing. So those are just a couple of examples of the kinds of things that we've learned from this new exchange, and I'm very excited to be leading that effort. And of course, this past year, one of the other major focuses of the agency was working with all of you through the legislative session, and one of the themes that we'll be hitting on in our presentation today is how we are now turning to implement some of the new historic investments that came out of the legislative session. So turning to that now, thanks to your leadership and your tireless efforts and the advocacy as well of our many partners, housing was a major theme in this legislative session in 2017 and a major recipient of state resources. The legislature made historic investments in housing and homeless prevention, including $40 million to support the emergency housing assistance and the state homeless assistance programs. Those funds, of course, are for not only ending homelessness but preventing homelessness. Through things like street outreach, rapid rehousing, rental assistance, transitional housing, and shelter programs. We also received $1.5 million to address veterans homelessness, which is a partnership with the Oregon Veterans Department, as well as $80 million in the Article 11Q General Obligation Bond LIFT program, the Local Innovation and Fast Track Housing Program, $25 million in lottery-backed bonds to support the preservation of federally assisted affordable housing, an additional $1.3 million for the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program, and in addition, the legislature renewed the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit and expanded the credit's cap to $25 million. So a few things that we wanted to highlight for you on those resources. $40 million for the EHA and SHAP programs. That is, of course, an historic investment in those programs. It will be extremely meaningful for local communities. We are working closely with our partners at community action agencies to develop a plan for the expenditure of those, an investment of those $40 million. We plan to come back in November to be able to report out to you what the plan is for investing those resources so that we can make sure that we are using those to the best effect for Oregonians. For the LIFT program, I'll go into a little bit more detail in a few moments, but as we're looking at the $80 million for LIFT, we're looking at two rounds of LIFT funding. Both of them would be $40 million bond sales, so we'll be talking a little bit more in detail about that. We're very excited about that initiative. $25 million for preservation, that is a bond sale that will take place in the spring of 2019, so we are working carefully with our partners now to plan for what that program will look like. And in February of 2018, we'll be reporting back to the legislature with our friends at ODVA on the new investment in veteran homeless dollars as well. On the policy side.
And before you move off of that slide,
yes.
I just wanted to make a comment in that the amount that typically goes to EHA SHAP every biennium and is considered, you know, eligible for roll-up is $10 million. In 2015, both Oregon and Eugene declared states of emergency. So in the short session 2016, we added another $10 million to that, which made it $20 million for the biennium, or if you want to look at it annually, $15 million for that particular year. And we knew that even that didn't keep up. We created a lot more shelters around the state. It got more people off the streets. It allowed counties to be able to provide funds for people whose rent had gone up astronomically to keep them in their homes as opposed to going to the street. It allowed people who were looking for housing and trying to get out of shelters to have first month deposit or relocation. So we knew that even the $15 million for that 1 year wasn't enough, but made an absolutely huge difference. You may have remembered in the beginning of the session last year, Mark Jolin came in and talked about specifically how they'd use that money. That was the basis for which we asked for, we actually asked for more than $40 million. We got $40 million this time around. But what I want to say is that that entire list is all one-time money, other than the $10 million that is typically given to EHA and SHAP. It's something that we have to come back for and fight every time. And that is just something that I still feel like we in this committee, as well as the legislature as a whole, need to continue looking at some of those structural issues where we typically don't have ongoing support for these kinds of things. We have to fight for it year after year. And the state has not seen housing as a core service that we need to be responsible for in the same way that we see healthcare and Medicaid or human services or education, where we're actually giving billions of dollars. So that is an ongoing dialogue that I'm having with this committee and that I hope that we can continue to have in the Capitol as a whole, because this is important. In my view, it doesn't even go far enough when you see all the people on our streets and, you know, the 40% of people out there renting, many of whom are very distressed. But it was a significant step forward, but it's one time. So just want to keep continuing to put that discussion on our radar about, you know, what is it that we as a state feel are essential core services that we should be providing in this arena, because housing leverages all those other supports in healthcare, education, human services, et cetera. So
thank you, Chair,
for allowing me to editorialize.
Thank you for your comments. Appreciate those. In addition to the one-time investments that the chair just described, we of course received as well some new authorities and some new policy tools for housing, which will be ongoing in statute, which we hope will be very helpful. So a few of those I wanted to just note for you, and just to kind of kick this off by saying that these are, we think, going to be helpful tools. We are in the process, of course, of staffing up as an agency to actually put these policies into place, working with stakeholders on advisory committees, developing rules. But the first step is to get the staff in place. So we're hiring. So on the record, we are hiring. We welcome folks to take a look at those opportunities and to get some new talent in to really help us launch these items. So the first one is the Affordable Housing Preservation Bill, which is HB 2002. I know you all discussed that at length, and we had a chance to talk with you all in hearings. This is a program, of course, that's modeled after the state of Massachusetts, but with some certainly some Oregon specifics in it. And it really provides us a framework as an agency to stand up a preservation program. This was a major theme in the Secretary of State performance audit, that our agency has not had a concerted program to preserve the existing affordable housing stock in Oregon. As the chair mentioned, from time to time, we've been lucky enough to receive resources, one-time resources, to focus on preservation, but we have not had a concerted ongoing effort on this. We think the structure will give us that platform. It requires notice to be provided to the agency when there are expirations of affordability restrictions and covenants on properties, as well as when properties are going to be sold, so that we can keep an eye on the inventory and make sure that we're identifying those properties that may be at risk and those tenants that may be at risk. It also allows us to work with partners to have the opportunity to purchase these properties and make sure that they stay in the affordable housing inventory. And it really also allows us to stand up and complete the work that we're doing on the data side of creating a comprehensive inventory of affordable housing properties across the state, not only the properties that we fund and manage and oversee, but also the properties that may be received funding from local governments or those federally assisted properties, so that we're really looking at the whole spectrum of affordable housing in Oregon. So, like I said, we're hiring for this program, and we hope to have it operationalized by January of 2018. I mentioned the land acquisition program. This is a program that we saw as a great potential after talking with our colleagues in Washington State. And so now that we have that statutory tool, we actually were able to identify some resources from the agency, from a dormant pre-development program that we decided to invest in this program to get it started. So we've identified $3 million to seed the program for this biennium. And we're really seeing this as an opportunity to take this program out, get it stood up, and see how it works over this biennium as a starting point. We hope to have this program live as well by January 2018. The rent guarantee program, which was HB 2724, was a rental assurance fund for tenants. It restores a mitigation fund at OHCS that covers a portion of landlord's expenses for damages caused by a tenant who has completed a tenant education program. I know this committee discussed this program at length. We do think that this provides an opportunity, certainly in this very tight rental market, to be able to provide that assurance to landlords and to help folks, anything we can do to reduce barriers for folks to get into homes. So that program as well will be stood up in January 2018. A couple of notes on the mental health housing program. This was HB 3063. This will be ongoing implementation. This really creates a formalizes a partnership between OHCS and our friends at the Oregon Health Authority, and establishes a program for the development of mental health housing and residential services. This follows on the investment of $20 million in mental health housing funds. We are working closely with our friends at the Oregon Health Authority. We're learning a great deal about the initial awards that we've made through that mental health housing program. We have stood up a permanent supportive housing working group that's a partnership between ourselves and OHA, and we've assembled some of the, I would say, best minds around permanent supportive housing and mental health housing to get around a table together to really talk about what it will take to get a successful mental health housing program and successful supportive housing programs up and running in Oregon. As a relation to that, we are putting out a request for information in the next few weeks to solicit feedback on the initial awards that we've made through the mental health housing program, and to really get more feedback on what it will take for us to roll out that program more formally, what that program will look like. And then finally, the State Home Oil Weatherization Program, SB 100. This transferred the State Home Owner Weatherization or SHO program into our agency from the Oregon Department of Energy. It brings new funding for the agency to support low-income weatherization for oil-heated homes. So as you can see, we're a little bit busy at OHCS, but we're very excited about the opportunity to get these programs rolling and to get the new resources out into the community. I wanted to spotlight the LIFT program because, of course, this is a significant investment. This is a new program and a new strategy for developing affordable housing opportunities across the state of Oregon. As you all know, we had an initial $40 million investment in LIFT, and we made the awards for LIFT in January of 2017. So we've learned a lot from that first cohort, and we're now looking at implementing the LIFT program in the next round. So we were awarded a total of $80 million in Article 11Q bonds for the LIFT program, and the funds will be allocated to OHCS in two different $40 million bond sales anticipated for May of 2018 and February in 2019. The first round of the LIFT program was focused exclusively on rental housing development. We're pleased that this second round, we now have the opportunity, because of a legislative change, to also focus on LIFT for homeownership. So that means that we'll be able to use LIFT not only to develop new rental housing, but to develop new for sale affordable housing homeownership units as well. In total, 80% of the LIFT funds will be set aside to develop rental housing opportunities, with 20% set aside for homeownership. But if due to funding requests, the target set aside percentages are not met in the first year awards, the funds allocated in year two of the LIFT awards will be adjusted to accomplish the target percentages. So we'll be able to adjust to what we're seeing out there in the marketplace and the kinds of requests that we're receiving from our partners out in communities. Key to the LIFT program design is meeting the owner operational requirements of the Article 11Q general obligation bond funding. So in collaboration with stakeholder input and initial legal advice, we have developed a draft LIFT framework for this next round. It addresses both rental housing and LIFT for homeownership. It includes specific proposed changes to the rental side to create a little bit more flexibility to make this resource more user-friendly and make sure that we're getting it out to communities in a timely fashion. So from the initial round of LIFT awards on the rental side, we heard two things. One thing we heard was that the per unit cost limits that we put on the LIFT awards were pretty rigid and didn't work well in rural communities in particular. So we wanted to be responsive to that. We're still really targeting and aiming to keep the costs down with this program, but we're allowing a little bit of flexibility so that the rural partners can come to the table with projects as well. We don't want them to feel excluded from the program. We want to make sure that that door is open. The second piece of feedback we heard from the initial round of the LIFT awards was we were very excited about pushing the partnerships with our housing development partners and our friends at DHS. We still think that those are very important partnerships, but we also know that a one-size-fits-all approach to resident services is not necessarily workable. And so our partners came to us and said they believe in services, they're committed to resident services. It's an important part of this program. They wanted a little bit more flexibility on how to structure the service partnerships. We thought that was appropriate. So those are two of the proposals that are in front of our Housing Stability Council now for consideration. We're also gathering public comment. So if the committee members have comments on that, we are happy to receive those as part of the public comment process as well. And certainly, we're also working with stakeholders on the homeownership side. This is a new component of LIFT, so we're working out the details of that, and we've been soliciting feedback from folks in the homeownership community as well. And speaking of LIFT, I was honored to represent OHCS at the very first LIFT groundbreaking right here in Salem. Cornerstone Apartments here in Salem will provide homes for 177 needy families, and will also offer innovative service partnerships with the local DHS office, the Marion Polk Food Share, the Mid-Willamette Valley Community Action Agency, and Northwest Human Services will provide services including life skills and financial courses, as well as a health clinic. It's a very exciting property. We will make sure to keep you all posted on it, and hopefully we'll be able to invite you to join us at the grand opening of the Cornerstone Apartments when that is completed. So that's detail on what's keeping us busy at OHCS, and I wanted to now turn the microphone over to Ariel Nelson, who will talk to you a little bit about the data work that we're doing and more detail about the work of the statewide housing plan. Thank you.
So Chair Kenny-Geyard asked about the point-in-time homeless count.
For the record.
Oh, for the record, my name is Ariel Nelson. I'm the Government Relations and Communications Liaison at Oregon Housing and Community Services. Thank you. So the point-in-time homeless count is conducted every 2 years. It's an effort by communities across Oregon to come together to identify the number of homeless individuals living in sheltered and unsheltered locations. It also looks at demographic trends surrounding homelessness and the unmet needs of homeless households. So we have one slide here, but what we're really excited to show you is going forward, we have this new dashboard for the point-in-time count, and you're able to compare this year's count, 2017, with 2015, down to the county level, and we also have lenses to show you. You can look at numbers for youth, and then if you wanted to look, for example, at Lane County, you'll see that you can track down to the different levels. And so we're just excited that we're able to dig into the data at this level. We also have a lens for veterans and a tab representing chronic homelessness. And just as a reminder, the point-in-time count is a study commissioned by HUD to help them inform their funding decisions for the coming years. And so a homeless person is an unaccompanied homeless individual with a disabling condition I'm sorry, that's the there's homelessness and chronic homelessness. Homelessness is if anyone who's living in some place not meant for human habitation. So the count reflects folks on the streets, in cars, as well as in shelters or transitional housing. The count also looks at chronic homelessness, which that is a very narrow definition for homeless individuals with a disabling condition, continuously homeless for 1 year, or it can reflect homelessness for episodes over 3 years. So the point I wanted to make with that is that we can dig into these various levels, these various definitions, and this is just going to be one tool that we have access to. And if you talk to the community action agencies and the local providers in your communities, you'll hear that this count really underrepresents the number of folks who don't have stable homes, who are doubled up in family members' houses, on couches, couch surfing. And so we just wanted to display that, you know, this is one way to look at it, but it's really important to dig into those metrics.
Thank you, Ariel. It's really important, and I'm hoping you can add that to OLIS because I don't see this particular page among your three
presentations. The link should be in the PowerPoint on OLIS. If you go to the slide that I first brought up, there's a link in the notes section that you should be able to access, but it's
under
not,
notes, I see. Yeah, it's not in the PowerPoint itself. Mm-hmm. So it's in, like, you click something else in it?
We'll make sure that you have
the
link.
We'll make sure that you have it.
Because I have the homeless count here, the preceding slide.
Yeah, it's down in the notes, but we'll make sure we get you the link. It's also up on our OHCS website. It's one of the banners. So just wanted to give you a taste of that. If you have any questions, as you look into your county-level data, please feel free to contact us. And we're happy to, you know, facilitate this conversations, have our data manager really get into the specifics with you. And we're actually, which leads me to our next part of the presentation, we are going to be out in your communities this fall for the Oregon Statewide Housing Plan. Director Salazar mentioned that, you know, we have a statutory mandate to actually conduct this long-term strategic plan for how the agency is addressing housing statewide. We do have the link to the website that has all the materials that we're sharing today. It will be continuously updated as we solidify the dates that will be in your communities, and we'll be adding a lot of county-level data. Because as I said, the point-in-time count is just one tool, and that is why we're really focusing on the other tools that the agency has at hand to really tell the story of not only homelessness, but housing need, homeownership, rent burden. You know, what are the, you have an example of the statewide data, and we have this at each of the county level as well that we'll be bringing to your community. So everything from employment and industry growth, home sales, building permits, we have all that information. So that brings me to what the statewide housing plan really is. It's the effort to place a greater emphasis on strategic planning and the way we invest our resources. Over the past several years, we've been restructuring, refocusing, and reimagining Oregon housing and community services. This work has led to a greater emphasis on data research and customer service, and so we're carrying that forward into this statewide housing plan. The plan will clearly articulate the extent of Oregon's housing problem and what can be done to address it. OHCS has committed to the Housing Stability Council and our stakeholders that the plan will be responsive to the needs of the state, delivered to the legislature, and include elements of our equity agenda. And to accomplish this task, we've brought on a consultant team, and we've been working with them the past several months. And so I'm pleased to share our next stage, which is bringing this story and this plan to your communities. What we know is that many Oregonians have limited or no choices when it comes to a place to live. Too many Oregonians are living in poverty and can't find a stable, healthy place to call home. We know that rental housing has become more out of reach than ever before, and homeownership is becoming harder to achieve and maintain, and is unattainable for many of the populations in Oregon. Many Oregonians are living paycheck to paycheck, and each month families and individuals are experiencing the effect of the housing crisis and the real threat of becoming homeless. We saw that Oregon had the largest increase in median rents from January 2013 to January 2017, with a 30% growth rate, rising from $1,242 to $1,619. And that's according to Zillow estimates that we are relying on. 27% of Oregon households have a severe housing cost burden. That means that they spent more than 50% of their income on housing and on utilities. And we also can, you know, graphically represent that in your brochure. And as I said, we'll be coming to you with the with the county level data. So the plan's going to prioritize investments so that more Oregonians can achieve housing stability, and it's going to focus investments and services to achieve the maximum affordable housing impacts, identify practical tools, best practices, and spell out specific roles and responsibilities. This is just an example of the elements that are foundational to the plan and the core principles. And then this is an illustration of kind of the process organized into four sections. The problem represents the assessment of the need, the depth of the need. That's that data that we're bringing to you. And it's also representing the tools, the resources to address the need. So we've identified the need. We're also working on an environmental scan, which is a scan of all of the available resources for affordable housing statewide. We're really focusing on reaching out to our agency partners to find out, we know the OHA has housing resources for mental health housing, ODVA, there's obvious partners there, but there's also just checking with other agencies to see what other programs, dormant funds, that kinds of things that we can be tapping into, cross populations, data sharing. That's all going into our environmental scan work. And then the plan is, it's going to inform and guide OHCS's priorities and investment strategies to address that need going forward, and that's that implementation box that you see represented there. Again, these are our core principles represented throughout the process. And this is another graphic representation with a timeline of the development process. We are in phase one. And that's what the outreach that we're going to be doing this fall. So on the back of the brochure that you have kind of a high-level explanation of the plan, you'll see a tentative schedule of where we're going to be around the state. These dates are slightly subject to change depending on availability and facility availability, but if you go to the link on the PowerPoint to our website, you'll see that the first group of dates that we're closest to, we do have exact times and locations set for those meetings, and we'll be reaching out to you and partners to invite you to participate. And the goal of these meetings is really not only to connect with our traditional housing partners like the housing authorities, community action agencies, service providers, but also to have a cross-sector conversation, because we know that housing, that everyone in every sector is feeling housing and cares about housing. So we would love to hear from you who in your community should be there, who in the school districts, who are the teachers that are working with homeless youth, public safety, which employers are having trouble, recruiting employees because there's no affordable housing for nurses and doctors to live in their communities. Those are the kind of people we want to see there, obviously the community leaders and elected officials. So please feel free to reach out to us. We'll be reaching out to you in advance, and we look forward to working with you. It's bringing this data. We'll be presenting the data, but then it's a conversation. What isn't represented in this data for your community? Do you have other data? What are the stories? What isn't reflected here? Is there, a plant that's closing down and you're going to lose jobs and you need to look at services and stability for those folks? Is it a new job opportunities or employment opportunities that your community may be missing out on? So does anyone have any questions?
Fantastic. Questions? Comments? This is fantastic work. Mm-hmm. It's what we've been wanting. It's what the audit called for. Mm-hmm. People ask me, big picture, what is it we need to, what do we have, what do we need, what's the gap, mm-hmm. what is it the legislature should ask for in a whole variety of different areas, from rental to home ownership to homelessness, and this is really important. And I hope that you will also email this link to our offices so our staff people get it. I've circled everyone I think I can do. I'm going to try to make as many as I can outside of my district as well, because I want to hear about other parts of the state. I invite all of you to go use it as an excuse for a vacation and visit a colleague and come to as many as you can. Certainly, if you can do one in your own district, that's really important. If you haven't already thought of this, I think it would be great if you would reach out to the League of Cities and Association of Oregon Counties and invite their city and county electeds to come to the ones that are in their area, because we need as many people as possible. I know all across the state people are concerned about this, and I want to make sure that they're very aware and can attend, because this will be fantastic information.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, for those comments.
We'll be presenting at the League of Cities conference later this month.
That's fantastic.
Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
Yeah, thank you. just to make sure I understood, did I see that about 20% or about $15 million will be coming from the LIFT program to actual housing or ownership instead of just rental?
That's right. The target is that 20% of the resources would be earmarked for the development of new for-sale affordable housing, so homeownership opportunities. Those are targets that we've heard from our stakeholders and partners that do housing development. That seems like an appropriate target. We do have a little bit of room to maneuver if that doesn't quite come to pass. If those developments don't come in the door, or if we have more demand for homeownership, we can take a look at those targets.
Great. And that's great to hear. Good.
Yeah, we're saying that none of the homeownership specific bills passed, but this was the one piece in homeownership that did go forward, and I know the homeownership community, the Affordable Housing Advocates for Homeownership, are really excited about this piece.
And Chair and Representative, I would just also add that one thing that's exciting for us is this is a new area of business for us to really fund at scale the development of for-sale affordable homeownership units. So we're delving into that not only with the LIFT program, but with the land acquisition program can also be used for for-sale units. So it's new. We're learning. We're working with our, again, other states as well as our developers across the state of Oregon to kind of learn about models that are going to be workable. So we look forward to doing that.
And they're actually quite small amounts of money when you think about the Portland housing bond. That was $258 million, I think. I consider this still really small, but it's an opportunity to pilot some things and learn by it and then hopefully bring it up to scale farther. And I think this is a great transition to our next panel, which is going to be looking at increasing bonding flexibility for the municipal bonding programs like the Portland one, but we also know that there are things that we could do to change the Constitution to make them more flexibility because of your requirement to have some kind of ownership operating, those might be some committee bills that we are considering, referrals to the ballot to look at that, and that's what our next panel will be. They're focusing on municipal bonds, but certainly we're also looking at what can we do to make sure that the program is as flexible as possible with the state bonds. So we'll be revisiting that piece probably in November.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Okay, our last panel on municipal bonds from City of Portland.
Chair Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Shannon Callahan. I am the Assistant Director for Policy and Strategy at the Portland Housing Bureau. I'm here today with Harvey Rogers, Bond Counsel with Delafield, Hawkins, and Wood, and Ken Rust, the city's Chief Financial Officer. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss Municipal Bonding Authority for Affordable Housing. Like many other communities, as we've just heard in Oregon, Portland is facing an affordable housing crisis. In the fall of 2016, Portland voters did pass a historic $258.4 million housing bond for affordable housing. This investment is dovetailing with other actions that the city has taken with the legislature's help. First, to adopt the inclusionary housing policy. We've also adopted a construction excise tax as part of the authority through inclusionary zoning. We've increased our urban renewal funds dedicated to affordable housing by 50%, raising approximately $67 million additional dollars in the next 5 years. We have streamlined our permitting process for affordable housing, giving projects priority permitting and dedicated staff if they are funded with city funds for affordable housing. We've also broken down traditional government silos by creating a joint office of homeless services with Multnomah County. Since the passage of the housing bond, the city staff and elected leadership have worked with a diverse stakeholder advisory group to maximize our bond investments. This will result in the development or acquisition of at least 1,300 units of affordable housing, all of which will be affordable to families or households below 60% of median family income. And in of that 1,300, at least 600 will be a deeply affordable to families earning less than 30% of the median family income. In moving forward with our bond implementation, a significant factor of consideration is Oregon's constitutional provisions that effectively limit our local government's ability to leverage general obligation funds with other funds. Increasing the amount of leverage means increasing the amount of housing we can provide under our bonding authority. With that, I would like to turn it over to Harvey Rogers.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Harvey Rogers. I'm with the private law firm of Hawkins, Delafield, and Wood, and I was asked by the people here to give you a little short background about me. I've been very fortunate. I've been doing almost exclusively municipal bond work in Oregon for over 40 years, and I have wonderful clients like the City of Portland and the Department of Administrative Services, other state agencies, and folks like that. So at least I've been around a while. This is an exciting thing. It went the wrong way, yes. An exciting thing for me, considering amending this provision of the Oregon Constitution. The prohibition on lending of credit has been a part of the Oregon Constitution since it was first written. And the proposal that y'all considered last session was to provide an exception to that for local government general obligation bonds. So local government general obligation bonds are a very special thing, and it can be really confusing because the state also issues general obligation bonds. The LIFT program is a state general obligation bond program, but state bonds work differently. For local governments, like the state, the bonds are very secure and they provide the lowest generally available interest rate. But the bond issue requires a vote of the people in the jurisdiction issuing the bonds. So like when the City of Portland issued general obligation bonds, city voters had to approve it. The Oregon Constitution provides that local government general obligation bonds can only be used for capital costs. So that's bricks and mortar, not costs of operating housing. And very significantly, the voter approval that local government general obligation bonds get allows the government to levy an additional property tax that is sufficient to pay the bonds. That's part of what makes the bonds so secure. So in 1857, when the Oregon Constitution was being written, it included Article 11, Section 9. And I won't fool you. Those of us who have studied it are mostly not very sure what it means. The concern back then was that local governments not be drawn into excessive private entanglements. But the language of the provision says no county, city, town, or other municipal corporation, by vote of its citizens or otherwise, shall become a stockholder in any joint company, corporation, or association, whatever, or raise money for, loan its credit to, or in aid of any such company, corporation, or association. So if you stare at that language, it's pretty clear that local governments can't own stock, but the rest of it's really fuzzy. About 100 years ago, in 1914, the Oregon Supreme Court invalidated a set of transactions involving a city bond that would have financed a railroad. Now, if you think about life in Oregon in 1914, railroads were essential to development. You just couldn't argue that that's not really good economic development. But the court said, no, the involvement with the private railroad company is excessive. You cannot do that. And the court basically hasn't said anything since then on that particular topic. When the state or a local government issues a bond, the market requires that the issuer get an opinion of what's called an unqualified opinion of nationally recognized bond counsel. So my firm is nationally recognized bond counsel. I'm nationally recognized bond counsel. And an unqualified opinion is a very, very strong opinion. It has almost no exceptions to it. Now, there is this thing called the National Association of Bond Lawyers, and it's hundreds of bond lawyers around the country, and they spend all this time thinking about bonds. And so they've written a whole lot about what an unqualified opinion is, and I won't bore you with that. Basically, lawyers who follow the National Association of Bond Lawyers standard can only give an unqualified opinion if they're confident that no judge would disagree with it. Well, if you look at our situation in Oregon, way back when, the Oregon Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. And it hasn't said anything since then. So we're sort of stuck being able to give an unqualified opinion on general obligation bonds for affordable housing where there is private involvement. That's the next part of this story. Governments have been trying to help develop affordable housing for a very long period of time. And they've developed a number of cool things that allow affordable housing to be done. One of them are low-income housing tax credits. Those are federal tax credits. And I'd be happy to give you the details, but basically you can't take advantage of federal tax credits unless the housing is privately owned. So if you use general obligation bonds right now, you can't take advantage of tax credits. There are federal agencies that loan money. They want to get their money back, and so they have rules about who owns the housing, and they would basically like to see the housing owned by special purpose entities, that is, private entities. So currently the rules prevent you from taking advantage of federal lending programs. And also, there are private developers who would like to help develop affordable housing projects, but they're putting their money in, so they'd like to own a hunk of it. And that's private ownership, and it's in the form of a corporation or other artificial entity, so that doesn't work. So we're in a situation right now where the city of Portland can issue general obligation bonds to finance affordable housing, but its hands are tied behind its back because it cannot take advantage of the many techniques that are out there that would allow greater use of the bond proceeds. So if you choose to ask the people to amend Article 11, Section 9, local governments will be able to issue general obligation bonds to finance affordable housing, and the housing will not have to be owned by the government. That's huge. That gives you access to tax credits and all kinds of other stuff. And it gives the city the ability, or the issuer, the ability to leverage the general obligation bond proceeds. Lots of affordable housing projects sort of almost work, but they don't completely work. And so you'd like to add a little bit of geo bond proceeds into the project to make it work. But right now, it comes with all these restrictions. You know, the government's got to own it, can't use the tax credits, so it doesn't work very well. And if you choose to amend the Constitution and the voters approve it, you'll get relief from that. I'd like to pass it to Ken Rust.
Question, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Meek.
A question regarding other states and how they run these general obligation bonds. Do they have similar language, or do they have similar constitutional amendments to their constitution that restrict them from this type of affordable, building?
Right. Chair Representative Meek, it's a really good question. Many states that developed their constitutions at roughly the same time as Oregon have similar provisions in the Constitution. Now, the way our legal system works is if there's a provision in the Constitution, then the courts of the state get to interpret that provision. They don't have to be interpreted uniformly. One state can say, well, it means this here, and another state can say it means that there. And the judges who are doing the interpreting are all lawyers, and it may surprise you to learn that lawyers sometimes disagree with each other. So there's stuff all over the country. As far as I know, there is not currently a local government general obligation affordable housing bond program. We don't know that, but it's very messy, and my expertise is in Oregon law, not law of other states.
And before you turn over, I just want to also correct the record on, you mentioned a bill that had come to us. We actually never dropped a bill.
Oh.
It came to us late in the session as Portland passed its municipal bond for affordable housing and then started running into these issues. It came kind of late in the session, so there never was a bill, if you're wondering why didn't I see a bill. But it is something that we thought, oh, this is really, you know, as you sit here and try to roll out your bond, and other cities may want to follow and do, you know, try to meet their own needs. Again, it's groundbreaking, and we want to do what we can to help partner with you and make it as flexible as possible. So that is why we will consider a bill this coming session.
Thank you for the correction.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Rust. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the City of Portland, and I've worked for the city for over 20 years in a variety of capacities, including the issuance of bonds. I'd like to spend a few moments this morning just sharing with you some of the concerns from a financial management point of view about expanding authority associated with general obligation bonds for affordable housing. Like many governments, the City of Portland has a lot of experience in issuing a wide variety of bonds, including general obligation bonds. So the mere fact that we may expand the potential use of a particular financing tool doesn't create a new kind of obligation for us that would be difficult to manage. We have a lot of expertise with that and been very successful with that over a long period of time. We do believe that expanded GO bond authority for affordable housing would help to grow overall resources that would be available to meet a very high priority community need that we're struggling with. The expanded authority for the general obligation bonds, we think, should be limited to affordable housing. We think that because of that high community need, that's prudent and it's sensible at this point in time. We also think that the voter approval aspect of that is very important. It increases transparency, and it makes sure that the voters have an opportunity to actually understand how we're going to be using those proceeds and the way in which those proceeds may be combined with private resources to help expand the funding base for affordable housing. As Harvey had mentioned, voter-approved general obligation bonds ensures that we have a dedicated property tax levy available to pay those bonds, and that makes sure that it's not going to compete with other general fund resources that are needed to support a variety of governmental programs. So by having it associated with the voter-approved GO portion of the financial management practice of governments, it expands resources, it leverages resources, but it doesn't compete with other resources. We think that's very important. We also think it would be prudent for any expansion of authority to place a limit on the amount of debt that could be authorized for this particular purpose. We already have debt limits for other kinds of activities. We think it would be prudent in this aspect as well. This balances funding for an important need like housing with taxpayer impacts. It helps retain bonding capacity for other programs that local governments want to engage in, and the City of Portland has a very active program for parks and other things, and so there are other things that are also very important in our community. And it's also consistent with best practices and the expectations of credit rating agencies that we're going to manage our overall debt burden in a prudent way that ensures affordability for the long term. So we think some kind of a debt limit would be important as well. Those are the things I wanted to share with you this morning, and be happy to answer questions and open it up for the rest of us as well.
Good. Representative Newman.
Thanks, Chair Kinney-Geyer. So, Mr. Rogers, it occurs to me that the framers of the Constitution were writing these provisions in to prevent entanglements between government and private entities. I would assume to prevent corruption. And I think that probably all three of you there, you're motives are pure and your uses of the changes of the Constitution that you propose would be useful. But is there a chance that this opens this up to corruption, that I want to develop a shopping mall and I can't get credit, or I can't get credit at the price that I want it, and so I somehow, through deals that I make, I use a municipality to get the credit at the price that would be favorable to me, or something like that? I mean, is there a chance that that could happen?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Nierman. Absolutely. I wouldn't think of it so much as a chance of corruption as I would a chance that government resources will end up being used inappropriately for private development. That is why the proposal that we've talked about has sideboards on it. It's general obligation bonds. They need to go before the voters. The exposure is limited to the additional tax that the voters would authorize. If you go forward with this, you have the ability to do something that would be really beneficial to a segment of the community that doesn't get much benefit, but it needs to be done carefully. Did I screw up?
No, Harvey. Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Nierman, I concur with the comments that Harvey made. You know, we do have a lot of experience with other types of financing, conduit revenue bonds, where we can use a bonding tool in combination with these low-income housing tax credits to leverage up funds, and have been very successful with that. So I think constraining it to a high-priority need like housing that utilizes the resources associated with a voter-approved GO bond measure to add to a leverage structure that we've experience with over many years is a prudent way for us to do that. Clearly, you know, our interest is to make this successful, and it depends on you know, people working diligently on behalf of the public to make that happen. But I think the sideboards that Harvey mentioned are really critical to making sure that it constrains the activity to those things that are the highest priority and gives the opportunity for voters to clearly weigh in and concur that this is the right direction to take.
I appreciate any questions around caution about this going forward. I'm very interested in doing everything we can to increase flexibility, and we need to have a lot of discussion before short session in where we only have basically 5 days to pass a bill out of our committee. What the bill would be a referral to the voters for a constitutional amendment. That's what it would be.
To remove that language from Section 9.
Exactly. Yeah. To keep the sideboards, but to add flexibility. And so exactly what that looks like. So so I'm hoping Representative Meek will work on this, and I would love it if somebody else from our committee, ideally bipartisan, somebody from the Republicans, would you like to work on it? That's fantastic. Yeah, if the two of you could work on that together, and really take a hard look at the language. And, you know, again, the goal is to add flexibility, keep the protective sideboards, but add flexibility. And I think the idea of public-private partnerships to expand what government can do on its own is really important. So thank you very much for working on that. I got the dynamic to go down there. Any other questions for the panel? Okay. I think that's it. I think that closes our informational hearing from our panelists. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm going to add a few comments here at the end. First of all, I want to recognize Ashley Clark when we did our introductions. We didn't get that far, so thank you. She's back. We have a great team who are going to be with us, I believe, throughout the session, and it's great to have continuity. We've had different people in this committee over the last few years, and it's fabulous to have continuity, so I really appreciate that. I want to just mention some dates coming up. Exactly. For all of you, November 21st is the LC request deadline for you to put in your two personal bills. I will be talking with my vice chairs about some ideas for committee bills this certainly is one, unless there's somebody who personally wants to put that on, take it on as a personal bill. We may have some tweaks to House Bill 1051, which was the one that evolved out of the House Bill 2007, a supply bill that where we forgot to mention that if churches were going to be developing property, it should be inside the urban growth boundary. So we're just taking a strong look at, you know, anything, any technical fix that is part of the purpose of a short session is tweaking bills that, you know, went through the session and there were a lot of things happening, and then when the dust settles, it gives us an opportunity to see where technical fixes are. I'd really like our committee bills to have some strong committee support on them. And there may be questions, but not big controversial items, so that's the intention. And I'm saving a slot, ideally, for something in the human services. Have a couple ideas. But if you have ideas that you'd like to bring to me for consideration of committee bills, or if we're talking about committee bills and you really want to claim them as a personal bill, a joint personal bill, then that would be great, too. So we'll have more on opportunity in the November session for everyone to talk about their personal bills that might be coming to our committee and give us a heads up about that. Certainly any committee bills that I will be planning on submitting, because the LC deadline is right after our November days, we will fully air them at that November hearing. January 8th is when we get our LC returned bills. January 16th is the drop deadline for bills. And again, committees get three bills, and the personal bills are two. On OLIS, I want to draw your attention that Cassie has put the bills that were enrolled that came out of this committee. Mm-hmm. So the last time you saw anything were all the bills that passed out of our committee, but we didn't meet again, you know, for the last few weeks of session, and so we never really had a conclusion about which of all of our bills actually made it through the entire process and were enrolled. And so we do have that. Thank you, Cassie, for putting that on OLIS. That's a nice summary for you. I want to mention that I am going to Washington, D.C. the second week of October, and I plan on going to the Low-Income Affordable Housing National Group. I forget the official name. If any of you have questions for me, I'm just going to set up some meetings. And if you have questions for me, one of the things I want to ask is, what are other states doing? I know that our Affordable Housing Alliance partners are constantly looking at what other states are doing. And this is just an opportunity for me to also hear firsthand. So if you have questions about particular areas that you would like me to be an ambassador for this committee as I go there, it's not the only purpose for my visit, but since I'm going to be there anyway, I really want to connect with them. So I think that's it for my comments. Does anyone else have anything they'd like to share? Okay. With that, we're out of here a little early. I'm going to close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We're out of here a little early. I'm going to close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.